Hello there, I'm Ed Butler and welcome to the download of Business Daily, where today we're looking at the money in your pocket and the people who control it.
I used to rely on international wire transfers, and I had to pay $40 every time I wanted to expend the fruits of my labor. For what? The banking system is doing an absolutely terrible job.
So why this man now uses digital currencies to save and spend? What are they? And are they safe? Also, why Greek students these days all want to wear a uniform?
Joining the ranks of the Greek military or police force at least offers a secure place in the public sector. And with one out of four Greeks currently unemployed, job security is goal number one.
Jobs and cash in the Business Daily podcast from the BBC. Now is the era of the digital currency upon us. You may not know much about it yet, but just as the internet has spawned the rise of e-commerce, it's also recently led to the emergence of e-money, Dosh, that only exists in digital form, and just like commerce over the internet, advocates say that it promises to revolutionise the global money supply. Since the invention of currencies, such as Bitcoin in 2009, it's seemed to some like a breath of fresh air. The freedom to ping money back and forth across the world without banks or governments charging you a penny in transaction fees for the privilege. Critics, though, see it differently. Transactions in these currencies, which also have other names like e-gold or Liberty Reserve, are hard to trace, often making them a magnet for crooks. Online drug deals are routinely transacted across the so-called dark web using Bitcoin, for example. A blackmailer recently demanded a big pile of the stuff to prevent him exposing the comprehensive tax returns of presidential candidate Mitt Romney. So the British cyber cop Mick Jameson specialises in internet fraud, and he cites numerous examples of dodgy people using Bitcoins to hide their dodgy activities.
It's filed under an account number. And the account number obviously is then referenced to your registration details. Of course, registering for a bank, you would be Mr. Jameson, you would give your address, something like that. This, you give your email address and you give them your IP address and any other details that they wish you to volunteer, whether they be true or false. But of course, they don't require the person to go in with a passport or a driving licence or proof of identification or financial history.
So basically you're saying criminals are all using it?
I think when it comes to the really high-level drug traffickers, they trust cash. But yes, any transfer or any transaction that takes place in an environment where people are using details to keep them anonymous makes it harder for law enforcement. It's obvious.
But are digital currencies really such a bad thing? Despite security breaches like the recent hack into a New York currency exchange leading to the theft of $250,000 worth of Bitcoin, advocates still say the currency's basic technology is sound. There's about $10 billion of Bitcoin in circulation at the moment. Donald Norman, who represents the Bitcoin consultancy, says as consumers gain confidence in it, so it could transform global commerce.
The security of the actual software, the Bitcoin software, is very, very good. However, the barrier to entry is so low that a lot of the people providing the outside infrastructure for Bitcoin have not been really securing their sites well enough. And that's just a growing pain.
Can you forge it? Like you can forge a banknote?
No, I mean, you can send requests to send funds you don't have, but merchants don't accept funds without a certain amount of time, a certain amount of confirmations. This is a settlement system. So we're talking about as secure as, you know, international wire transfers, as irreversible as basically anything that exists.
So if someone was trying to settle with me, I was offering to sell them something, I don't know, a bicycle over the internet, for instance. They send me Bitcoin. I could, in that 40 minutes, easily vouchsafe that this 200 Bitcoin they were sending me was valid.
Yeah, I mean, if there was a single confirmation, I would feel very, very safe with lots of money. If I was selling the house, I would, you know, want about four confirmations. But I would. That's still sort of, you know, my paranoia. I think Bitcoin's biggest problem is the network effect and the adoption effect. Right now, it's been adopted by people who are really tech-savvy. And it needs to get to a certain level of user friendliness to be able to reach its second, you know, sort of adoption phase. You know, in my previous job, I used to rely on international wire transfers. And I had to pay $40 every time I wanted to expend the fruits of my labor. And that's 1% of my income for what? For basically paying to try to stop criminal activity like money laundering, the banking system is doing an absolutely terrible job.
So how come people don't trust Bitcoin?
Like I said, it's the outside infrastructure. There's been a lot of thefts. If you have...
It's just bad PR, you mean?
Well, I think that Bitcoin attracts a lot of unsavory people, an incredible amount of unsavory people. You know, people will be duped, but that happens in every currency.
So you are saying that people are not using Bitcoin now simply because they're scared and they don't understand it, not because there's anything inherently wrong with it?
Yeah. I mean, I also do think, though, it's not ready for a lot of people who do not know how to secure their computer. So, like I said, the outside infrastructure isn't there. There are not many trusted brands. I remember when I was, you know, younger, which wasn't so long ago, and people said, don't use your credit card online because you will get robbed. Actually, what happened is people realized that they shouldn't use their internet online on sites that they don't trust.
So, Donald Norman argues, once Bitcoin becomes simpler and a little more familiar to the less technically aware, we should all be using it. At a time when the European single currency threatens to disintegrate under a mountain of sovereign debt, it does seem a tempting thought. But remember, the reason that Bitcoin is so cheap to use is partly because it's so unregulated, a haven, some claim, for swindlers and money launderers. I turned to Greek economist Yanis Varoufakis. He's best known for expounding on the Eurozone's woes, but recently he's also added a sideline as a consultant to a games maker, Valve, which has been thinking about developing digital currencies within its online games. I asked him, since the creation of Bitcoin in 2009, who was actually using it?
In the case of Bitcoin, there was, while trust was preserved before the breakdown of trust, it was even used, at least in the United States, in pizza parlors and various shops that accepted Bitcoin. So it became quite a successful alternative to standard currencies. In other circumstances, for instance, in video games like EVE Online, the company that puts together this game is the one that issues the currency, and it becomes effectively a private central bank. Now, of course, the problem there is when you have a private corporation that is in control of a currency, there has to be trust in that private corporation's propensity to not only look after its own profits, but also to look after the stored value of its customers.
I mean, there have also been criminals using it, outlaws, Syrian rebels. There's been a whole array, hasn't there? It has had a great popularity on the dark web between those exchanging, you know, illicit contraband.
But that's natural, isn't it? When you are creating a currency whose purpose is to be unregulated, and then that currency gains value, and its exchange rate with the dollar or the pound sterling increases, then clearly this is going to act as an attractor to all sorts of people who want to launder their illicitly earned monies. This is one of the problems that all digital communities will have to face. Indeed, it's a problem that casinos face, all sorts of parallel monetary systems face.
Theoretically, I suppose, the dreamers have imagined that we could one day develop currencies that somehow bypass central banks, in the same way that the internet itself seems to revolutionise commerce, that an online currency could bypass the men in grey suits who've controlled everything up till now.
Indeed, whenever there is some significant technological innovation, great expectations that cannot be sustained by the facts and the technologies form. Digital currencies offer us zero production and distribution costs. So take, for instance, the Eurozone crisis that you and I have talked about in the past. If Greece were to reconstitute its own currency, it would take at least 8 months to do that. With digital currencies, you can create them at the touch of a button. That is a great merit of the technology. What it does not offer you is the opportunity of escaping the need for strictures and for regulation.
And I suppose this gave you a global currency, didn't you? And one thing it got past was any transaction costs between different currencies. You could transact from someone in Afghanistan with someone in America, and theoretically it was just one unit winging its way across the world.
Indeed, these digital currencies are global currencies, which raises many interesting issues concerning taxation, of course, because when you are actually trading in these currencies and even investing a great deal of labor, personal labor and effort and capital sometimes in activities that earn you value within those communities, then the big question arises, so where do you get taxed? Now, if you are a libertarian and you think that taxation equals theft, then you don't care much about this question because the answer you will give is, let's not get taxed and let's allow the states, the various states, to wither. But if, on the other hand, you believe that states are essential for maintaining civilized behavior and for having regulation, then it is a problem.
So you wouldn't be advising Greeks to convert their euros into Bitcoin or e-gold or anything else for the time being?
I wouldn't. And the worst part of it is that I would advise them to put them in a German bank.
There you go, a lesson for us all. Greek economist Yanis Varoufakis. You're listening to Business Daily from the BBC with Ed Butler. The sound, once again, of angry workers back on Europe's streets. Another general strike in Greece as workers once again say no this week to another painful round of cuts. Of course, an awful lot of Greek workers no longer work at all or have much prospect of it. It's a painful truth that, in fact, is having some marked effects on the behaviour of students, it seems, at least according to our regular commentator from Thessaloniki, Georgios Christadis.
It used to be doctor, lawyer, engineer, the holy trinity of professions that most self-respecting Greek families groomed their children to follow, since social status and a handsome living were practically guaranteed. The result being that there are currently more lawyers in Thessaloniki, Greece's second city, than in the entire lawyer corps of Sweden or Austria. But that was before the crisis. The undoubted champions now face hard competition. As the recent results of the National University Entrance Examination showed, the new ambition of many Greek 18-year-olds is to wear a uniform. Military and police academies have become equally popular choices among high school graduates with top grades. Law school, med school and engineering departments are still very popular, of course, but job market realities and Troika-imposed reforms are taking their toll. Doctors are forced already to make a living with 1,400 euro salaries, while illegal yet rampant gifts by grateful patients are now almost extinct. Greek engineers are fleeing to Saudi Arabia, Germany, or any other country with job prospects, since the real estate market in Greece is virtually frozen. As for lawyers, they had been suffering in their crowded market even before the crisis, but now only a few can make a decent living. Especially after the Troika insisted on eliminating many perks, including the obligatory fee they earned for dozens of legal transactions. The tens of thousands of young Greeks who desperately wanted to enter the military and police academies this academic year realize, of course, that they will not be getting rich by the career path they chose. Public spending cuts and brutal austerity have meant that Greece currently employs jet fighter pilots with 1,000 euro salaries flying multi-million euro aircraft. But joining the ranks of the Greek military or police force at least offers a secure place in the public sector, and with one out of four Greeks currently unemployed, job security is goal number one. Getting accepted by the police and the army offers the additional benefit of not burdening your family's budget during your student years. Military and police academies offer, in addition to guaranteed employment, tuition-free accommodation and training. Serving your country is, of course, a noble ambition and profession. But in the era of globalization and cutthroat national competition, where success is linked to producing high-skilled graduates in cutting-edge service sectors, it is also a telling sign about the future prospects of the country. If for so many talented young men and women, all Greece seems capable of offering is the choice between leaving the country or wearing a uniform, much more will need to be done to protect this country's dwindling number of inhabitants. For the BBC World Service, this is Yorgos Christidis in Thessaloniki.
Well, now, some figures for you. Over the last 30 years or so, the US economy has doubled in size. But over the same period, the mountain of debt in the country has risen sixfold as Americans rely ever more heavily on their banks and a credit-fueled economy. So is there a measurable point at which a nation's banks become not an aid, but a burden to the country's productive economy? Hugo Panisa is chief of the Debt and Finance Analysis Unit at UNCTAD, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, and he's done a study and reckons that there is.
There is a result that has been known for a long time that, in general, the size of the financial sector leads to higher economic growth. And what we asked a few years ago is whether there is a threshold, there is a point at which this result no longer holds, and whether above this threshold actually a larger financial sector is bad for economic growth. And that's what we find, exactly. We find that finance is good for growth in country with relatively small financial sector, but when the financial sector becomes larger than the size of the economy, actually finance becomes bad for growth. So that's the fact that we establish in our paper.
Just over the last 20 years then, in a country like the United States, the amount of finance, the amount of credit, has grown exponentially.
In the US and in almost every country in the world.
By how much?
In the US it grew, the size of the financial sector more or less doubled over the last 20 years.
What is the limit? I mean, can you quantify the point at which finance tips over the balance, if you like, into an area where it is simply fueling debt?
Yeah, so our estimates, estimates are never precise, so I cannot give you a precise number, but the range in which we find that which finance starts being bad for growth is between 90 and 110 of GDP. So it starts becoming bad when the private credit becomes as large as the size of the economy. So certain estimation gives us a number of 92%, other give us a number of 110%. So these are estimations, so we'll never be able to say the number is one or two, but we find robust results in this range between 90 and 110%.
That's the tipping point. And looking at the major Western economies in Europe and the United States, for example, what's the average level at the moment?
What is perhaps more interesting is to think what was the level before the crisis, because the crisis, leads to a lot of changes. So if you think at the level in 2006, just before the crisis, the country with the largest financial sector compared to the size of the economy was Iceland, which had a financial sector was about 250% of GDP.
And things didn't go very well for Iceland, did they? Ugo Panizza of the UN there. Your thoughts, do let us know. world.business@bbc.co.uk.